This is program C-1096. Before we begin, I want to remind you we're 30 weeks or 210 days away from our trip to Israel. And I really want to encourage you, if you're thinking about going or if you know anybody that might be interested in going, to point them or yourself to intotheword.net and check out the brochure right there online and then start making your plans. And make sure you talk with your leadership about sending your preacher with me. I promise you, he will come back so on fire, you'll hardly be able to stand it. And I only say that with a little tongue in my cheek. Let's go ahead and get back to the study we're doing right now, which is talking about the rebellion and the destruction of Jerusalem that happened in AD 66 through 70 when the temple was destroyed. It lasted a little bit longer than that afterwards. But this is something that was prophesied in the book of Daniel and something which Jesus himself prophesied. And the big thing that we were wrapping up with last time is that when the Roman legion, the 12th Roman legion, set up their camp on Mount Scopus, which is just across the Kidron Valley from the Temple Mount. It's where Hebrew University is located right now. This was, in fact, the fulfillment of the warning that Jesus gave, that when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place where it does not belong, get out of town. And all we have to do is go to Luke's paraphrase of what Jesus said in Luke 21:20, and we can see that it was about armies showing up, because it says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, or perhaps by armed encampments, then recognize that her desolation is near and get out of town. And so we have a historian from later in church history, Eusebius, who passes on to us that it was at that moment when Cestius set up his Roman encampment on Mount Scopus that Jewish believers in Jesus remembered the prophecy and got out of town. Let me read to you Eusebius' own words. It comes from the History of the Church, Book 3. But the people of the church in Jerusalem had been commanded by a revelation, vouchsafed to approved men there before the war, to leave the city and to dwell in a certain town of Perea called Pella. And when those that believed in Christ had come thither from Jerusalem, then as if the royal city of the Jews and the whole land of Judea was entirely destitute of holy men, the judgment of God at length overtook those who had committed such outrages against Christ and his apostles and totally destroyed that generation of impious men, end quote. So that was his take on the great migration of Jewish believers in Jesus from Jerusalem in Judea to Pella in modern-day Jordan, a little bit southeast of the Sea of Galilee. And that's where they set up their new Christian community in exile because they knew what was coming next, that there would not be one stone left upon another on the Temple Mount. All of it would be torn down because that's what Jesus said. And he also said that there would be a lot of death and destruction, and only by God's grace of shortening the days would there be anyone that survived this event. And we'll eventually get to the figures of casualties, and you'll appreciate what Jesus meant when he said those words of, unless God stepped in, no one would have survived it. Okay, so the 27th day of the 7th month, this is basically the beginning of November in 66. Cestius, the legate, the Roman legate of Syria, sets up his camp. And he wanted to give the Jews a chance to cool down and to maybe repent of their rebellious attitudes. So a few days later, on the 30th, he went into the upper part of the city, That would be the wealthy area where the administrative centers were, where the palaces were located. But he didn't go any closer to the Temple Mount than there. It's several hundred yards away, but it's significant when you've got a lot of buildings between you and the Temple Mount. The Romans, though, were attacked by the Jews for the next 5 days as they tried to occupy that place up to the west of the Temple Mount. And they lost a lot of people. On the fifth day of the eighth month, Cestius inexplicably withdrew his forces from Jerusalem back to Mount Scopus. And I do mean without explanation, because nobody understands why he did this. Just suddenly, he says, all right, everybody back to the Mount Scopus encampment. And he lost a whole bunch of people during this retreat back to the fortress on Mount Scopus. The following day, he decides to totally abandon this effort at Jerusalem and head for the coast to Caesarea. Maybe he was planning to go there and build up reinforcements or call for reinforcements from elsewhere in the empire. But it ends up being a fighting retreat, and really it turns into a rout. Because the Jewish people, the Jewish rebels, know the route that he has to take, and so they keep running up ahead, get the high ground ahead, and assault the forces that are on the road toward Caesarea. Now, normally, it would be a two-day march from Caesarea, from Jerusalem to Caesarea, but they basically take shelter in a fort that's partway along the route for 2 days, and they are barricaded in there by the Jews, by the Jewish rebels. On the eighth day, Cestius decides that the only thing that's left is for him to leave a small diversionary force behind and for the bulk of his forces to make a run for it. And so he leaves a couple of hundred people behind in the fort, and the rest of his people leave in the middle of the night. The Jewish rebels recognize when daylight comes that there's only a few couple hundred Romans left in the fort. So they attack it, they slaughter those guys, and then they take off to track down the remaining forces on the road. And eventually, Cestius orders his men to abandon all their equipment and to just every man for himself get back to Caesarea and to security. When everything is finished, this is what Josephus tells us the casualty situation was. Cestius's original army had almost been completely annihilated. He lost 5,300 foot soldiers. That's most of a legion. And he lost 380 of his supporting horsemen for that legion and every last bit of their equipment. And we're talking about some serious artillery here. Machines that could throw rocks accurately for a fairly decent distance, and which could also shoot oversized arrow bolts a good distance, and some multi-arrow launchers where you could shoot a whole bunch of arrows with one activation of this machine. So they lost a whole bunch of that artillery. The Jewish people picked that artillery up and took it to Jerusalem, and even though they originally didn't know how to use it, they, through trial and error, eventually figured it out, and they used it in the fight against the Romans that came against Jerusalem later. Now, of course, the destruction of a Roman legion was big news. This seldom happens. And when the Jewish people in the city of Jerusalem, who were still hoping that the the Romans and the forces of King Herod Agrippa II could relieve them of the rebels, when they realized that that didn't look like it was going to happen anymore, that the rebels were going to be taking over the city, they abandoned it. Josephus writes it in this fashion. After this calamity had befallen Cestius, many of the most eminent of the Jews swam away from the city as from a ship when it's going to sink. So they realize this is going to get bad. So a lot of these Jewish people abandoned the city. But a lot of Jewish people poured into the city because they now supported the rebel cause, which in their mind was an independent Judaism, an independent Jewish state. Now, what else happened here? Well, later in the eighth month, there were 10,000 Jewish citizens of Damascus up in the north that had been detained on the grounds of the public gymnasium of Damascus. They were put there because apparently the non-Jewish people in Damascus thought it was safe to intern them there. This is an internment camp. The moment they found out that the 12th Legion had been pretty much annihilated, they executed all 10,000 of these detainees. And then in that same month, the Jewish rebels began to mobilize for war against the entire Gentile world. They figured this is all Jew against Gentile. And it was at that point that Josephus, who is the source of much of our information of this time period, was designated to be the Roman general of Galilee. Now, he was only 29 years old at that time, but he was a priest. He was a member of the famous Hasmonean genetic line, so he had kind of royal blood in him from back in the past. He belonged to the Pharisaic sect, so he was a very conservative religious Jew. But he was also well known for being intelligent and strategic in his thinking. And so that's why they make him the commander of the Jewish resistance in Galilee. Now, the weird thing is, when you read Josephus, he says that earlier he'd been warning his friends, warning his acquaintances, it would be foolish for us to try to rebel against Rome. It would be foolish for us to take on the empire. But when it comes down to the Jewish nation taking on the Roman Empire, he feels that he owes his loyalty to supporting them in that. It's actually not unlike things that happened during our American Civil War, where some of the people who trained with Northern generals, went to school with Northern generals, were themselves supporters and friends of generals in the North. When the Civil War broke out, they severed those ties and went to the South. Some of them didn't even necessarily agree with the reasons for the war, but they felt that they owed loyalty to their state over the friendships that they had with people in the North. And so that's kind of what happens with Josephus, is he's like, this is a stupid idea, but if you're going to do it, yes, I will fight with all my might against the Romans who try to come in and stop us from being an independent nation. And I don't remember if I said this yet. He was only 29, so he's a fairly young man when this happens. Now, I am going to skip over a lot of the things very rapidly now that happens during the years, the latter part of 66 and 67, because it's really not as pertinent right now to our study. Effectively, Josephus looks at the tens of thousands of militia that he is taking under his command up in Galilee, and he goes, these guys, they don't have a chance against Rome the way they are right now, but they're willing to take orders. So he starts ordering them to organize like the Romans, and he teaches them to use Roman command structure and Roman tactical maneuvers and the signaling system that the Romans used as well. And the reason he could do this is because one of his closest friends was actually a Roman centurion. He comes into the story later. So he's doing all of that. Now, obviously, Nero is eventually advised that Judea is in full-blown rebellion. So that happens in the fall of 66. Nero is only 28. He's basically a kid. And once he learns about it, he designates Vespasian, who is a war hero of Rome in Germany and Britain. He's 55 years old. He taps Vespasian to go to Judea and deal with this. And so he does. Now, before we continue with him, let's go back to Josephus. Josephus runs into a problem with a guy up in the north named John of Giscala. And this guy doesn't like Josephus being in charge. He'd rather be in charge. And he actually tries to kill Josephus. And this John of Giscala eventually becomes the leader of one of the rebel gangs that fights with other rebel gangs in Jerusalem itself. So Josephus is using the winter of 66 and 67 to get ready for the inevitable Roman return to the land in force. And now, down in Jerusalem, the Jewish rebels are having problems with their own rebels because they've got a guy by the name of Simon, the son of Gorbas, who is taking advantage of the chaos to plunder the area around Judea. And the Jewish rebel authorities try to deal with him, and he retreats to, guess where, the Masada fortress, and makes that his headquarters of operation. So again, we've got, in the middle of all of this, Jew-on-Jew violence. A lot of this Jewish gang is against this Jewish gang, which is against that Jewish gang. All right, so Vespasian, the Roman general, he arrives in Antioch in the late winter or early spring of 67, and he's got his own 15th legion. He's got three client kings from the area of Syria, including King Agrippa II and all of their armies, so they are his auxiliaries. He takes this unified army and he goes down to Ptolemais, which is where on the coast is that little bump of Mount Carmel. It's in that area there. So at Ptolemais, he's joined by his son Titus, who's 27. He has just arrived from Egypt, bringing the 5th and 10th legions. Then these three legions and these three client king armies are reinforced by even more military elements and auxiliaries until finally, when he's ready to start his work, Vespasian has 60,000 well-trained and well-equipped soldiers and horsemen and long-range snipers and things like that under his control. And he's got lots and lots of support personnel that's feeding and carrying their baggage as well. And so as soon as the people of Sepphoris see this, Sepphoris was the largest city of Galilee at this time. It's about 4 miles north of Nazareth. If you go with me to Israel, we visit Sepphoris and see the ruins there. The leaders of that big city reach out to Vespasian and his armies, and they pledge their allegiance back to Rome. They had joined Josephus to begin with, but once they see this massive army being put together, they give up and say that they want to be on the winning side, which they expect is going to be Rome. And then, as I said, Josephus is doing his best to train his soldiers to fight against the Romans and win. But long story short, Josephus doesn't have a chance. His preparations are overrun pretty rapidly all through Galilee. His soldiers are defeated in all the engagements. He ends up taking refuge in a city of named Jotapata, which is a few miles north of Sepphoris. And he is able to hold out there for 47 days, but eventually the Romans take the city. And a lot of the Jews committed suicide rather than be taken captive. And Josephus was actually at the bottom of a well area, off in a cave to the side of the well, with a bunch of these guys that decided to get involved in a suicide pact, even though he kept telling them, we ought to surrender. We ought to surrender. They would offer us a chance to live. Even if we become slaves, we could still live. And nobody wants to do that in this suicide pact. And so eventually, by the way that the lots are drawn, the only two people left are Josephus and one other guy, and he finally talks that other guy into surrendering. And so that's how Josephus survives the Roman attack on Jotapata and the attempt of suicide by the Jews that didn't want to give up. And he, instead of being killed by the Romans, he is looked at as being someone to be admired because he was able to delay them better than anyone else that they'd fought against. So they're kind of intrigued by him. And so they keep him alive with the intent of taking him back to Rome after everything is over with. But when Josephus hears them saying that they're going to take him back to Nero, he says, well, why don't you just deal with me because both you and your son will eventually be emperors. And this intrigues Vespasian because he has enough of a religious streak in him that he is willing to consider the possibility that Josephus is a prophet. And so he keeps Josephus kind of as a part of his staff for the rest of the war. Now, understand, this does not go over well with the Jewish rebels, that one of their chief commanders in Galilee has pretty much joined the staff of the enemy general. And so there is still to this day a lot of hatred for Josephus for what they consider his betrayal of the Jewish independence movement of this time. They'll even say that even in his writings, he's so very pro-Roman. Well, there might be some of that, but I have to say that in my reading of Josephus, I think that he tries to be quite honest in his telling of the story, that he thought this was a wrong thing to do. And that he, and we will read some of these passages before we finish our study, he actually believed a lot of this was God's judgment upon the Jewish people for their abandonment of his righteousness and his holiness. And he would be saying that from his own Pharisee viewpoint, that the Jewish people had become too secular and too immoral and that God was actually bringing judgment upon them with all these things. So I would encourage you to read through Josephus on your own and make your own judgment call as to what you think about his mindset. Now, the military operations in Galilee were pretty much finished by the summer going into the fall of 67. It just didn't take very long. And there were 87,500 plus dead Jewish soldiers at the end of that six-month operation. And the next thing that's going to happen is that they're going to have to start moving south toward Jerusalem. And that is going to bring us into the next part of the story, which we're going to have to really get into tomorrow. And that is John of Giscala, who was the big troublemaker for Josephus, when he realizes that the Galilee has fallen to the Romans. He abandons it. He actually tricks the Romans into giving him a head start, but he abandons it and heads down to Jerusalem. And he becomes one of the gang leaders in the city of Jerusalem that start fighting with each other really badly during 67 and 68 and 69. So that really, when the Romans do finally start their final push on the city of Jerusalem in 70, there's already been a huge number of Jewish deaths because they've been killing each other off. Well, we'll kind of mark our place there in the year 67, and we'll get back into this tomorrow.